Welcome to Morning Report Top Stories, a selection of news from Radio New Zealand National's Morning News Programme.
Well, it's here. The Rugby World Cup in Japan kicks off tonight with the opening ceremony and the opening game between hosts Japan and Russia in Tokyo. Tonight's festivities will open the first World Cup in Asia, and fans are excited about their team's prospects and the chance to embrace Japan's culture, food and entertainment. Rugby reporter Joe Porter is in Tokyo and took to the streets to gauge the average punter's predictions.
I'm supporting Wales.
You're confident in their ability to actually lift the William Weir Ballast Cup?
Absolutely.
What makes you so confident?
Because we're that good.
Drunk.
David from Wales, drunk with self-belief. However, his travelling companions have other ideas about who will take out the tournament.
England's my team. I think anybody that beats England will win the World Cup. Typically English, they think they're going to win everything all the time.
England fans are also heavy on the ground, and Kat is as confident as a tiger in a chook house.
I think we're going to win. I just feel like we're in the same build-up, the same momentum as we had in 2003.
Springboks fan Richard is picking his boys to go all the way, and he says the victors at this World Cup, the first outside the traditional rugby nations, will be true world champions.
The winner of this World Cup is the best in the world. This is not a New Zealand World Cup or South Africa or England. This is neutral. So whoever wins this World Cup can say they're number one. Not all the bullshit of playing in each other's countries.
It's the first time in Japan for Richard and his wife Debbie and their friends Chris and Bev, and they're loving every minute, even if they couldn't get tickets to the biggest show outside of the World Cup. Anything in Tokyo, Japan that you really want to see before you go?
Sumo wrestling, but we can't get in.
I tried as well. It's impossible.
Jeez, it's like hard to mind, eh?
What about food? Do you have some favourite Japanese food you're looking forward to?
Sushi will be on the hit list.
Food is an omnipresent theme among fans, and French South African Martin and his Dutch partner Emma are no different.
Food. A lot of food, and we're planning a trip through most of Japan. There's going to be lots of culture. He's a big history nerd, so it's going to be lots of samurai stuff.
My wife would love you.
Yeah, yeah, lots of travel, lots of sightseeing, history, food, culture,
yeah,
all of it.
Try our hand at surfing too.
But is Emma in Japan for love or for her love of rugby?
It started for love, but now I'm definitely here for the rugby. So 4 years ago, I was living in Paris, and we watched the Rugby World Cup from the bars there, and he introduced me to the sport. I still call Scrum a strongman competition because that's how I learned the rules. So 4 years ago, we were dreaming about going to Japan for the next Rugby World Cup.
Martin is a French fan, but he believes the difference between the All Blacks and everyone else is as stark as night and day.
The best way to describe rugby nowadays, kind of like how we describe football with the Germans, is that rugby is just two teams playing against each other, and then the All Blacks end up winning in the end. So,
All Black fans aren't as ubiquitous as the Welsh supporters, but I counted at least 100 in Shinjuku last night, including Māori Aussie, or Mozzie, Josh. Some Chiefs mana on your chest there, bro.
Yeah, that's it, bro. That's it. Got to represent the Chiefs mana.
Which means you must be supporting the All Blacks too.
Definitely, definitely. All about the ABs, brother.
Favourites?
Definitely.
Keaton is also backing the ABs to defend their crown, and he's backing this World Cup to be the best one yet. He's only been in Tokyo for 2 days, but has already fallen for Japan, largely through his stomach.
Loving it so far?
Yeah, it's awesome. Everything's huge here compared to NZ. So.
What about the culture, the food, the language, you're embracing all of that?
Food's absolutely amazing. Had ramen like 3 times already.
Keaton and fellow All Blacks fans will be hoping to cap their Japanese experience with a three-peat of World Cup titles. In Tokyo, mō te hōtaka o te atene, ko Joe Porter aho.
Meanwhile, Kiwis here are gearing up to watch the action, whether it'll be at a bar or at home. The excitement is building, and one bar owner in Blenheim is willing to put $1,000 on the tab if he can pick the All Blacks' first try scorer. Our reporter Anand Zaki has the story.
Blenheim publican Warren Croft is putting a lot on the line for the Rugby World Cup. The owner of Fairweathers in the centre of town says bar patrons will get plenty of refreshments if he can correctly pick which All Black will score first against the Springboks tomorrow. It's been a tradition at the bar since the days of the old Super 14 competition.
What we found that by picking a player in advance, of course they had to be able to start the game, to be on the field, to have that opportunity. It just added that extra bit of excitement with the game, and we found that people would come down, watch the game, look particularly for that first try. Whether or not we got it was incidental.
Mr. Croft says Japan's closer time zone to New Zealand means he's hoping for some busy afternoons and evenings at Fairweathers. He says rugby still enjoys a strong following in the area, despite more sports now being on offer.
Rugby is certainly one of those sports, a bit like the racing, rugby racing and beer. They do go hand in hand with hospitality to the extent that it is certainly a sport that does go well with people relaxing and having a few drinks. And that's what we're all about.
Meanwhile, in the Waitaki town of Kurau, also known as Richie McCaw Country, locals are looking forward to the tournament. Kurau Hotel manager Ross Payton says the bar recently signed up for a package to show Spark Sport from their Sky TV decoder, a feature only available to commercial premises. Spark Sport have the rights to show the Rugby World Cup in the country.
Oh, we'll run a sweepstake on the night of all the bigger games, so long as we've got a few in the bar, and that's good. And our local rugby club, it's running a sweepstake on the whole, naming all the winners right through the whole tournament before it starts.
Mr. Payton says with Kurau being the hometown of former All Black captain Richie McCaw, rugby has a strong following.
Yes, there is. Richie's still in everyone's mind, even though he's not there now. But the All Blacks get a good following from Kurau. And it's something that we enjoy. We enjoy watching them.
On the streets of Christchurch, Marcus Tabrak says he won't be able to watch the opening games live because he doesn't have Spark Sport and will be watching delayed action on TVNZ.
Yeah, normally try to watch it on Sky, but not an option this year, unfortunately.
Are you going to watch it with mates or sort of...?
Yeah, we'll just see how it goes. I guess there's a few midweek games, right, and it's pretty late, so probably watch the big ones with friends, and then maybe some of the second-tier opposition teams that we're playing we might even miss, I'm not sure.
Australian visitor Max Tunks will be watching the tournament closely in hotels and bars during his 4 days in the South Island. He is confident that the All Blacks won't win the tournament this year.
Springboks is going to take the All Blacks. All Blacks are gone this year. They've had their run. No Dan Carter, no Richie McCaw. It's over for them. It's over. It's Aussie's turn now.
But back in Kurau, Ross Payton believes the All Blacks are a good chance of winning their third World Cup in a row, starting with a win over South Africa tomorrow night. For Morning Report, ko Ananzaki tēnei.
New evidence has forced the Operation Burnham inquiry to suspend its hearings investigating claims of civilian deaths in a New Zealand-led raid in Afghanistan in 2010. Yesterday, the inquiry was shown a register of classified documents that had been locked away in a defence safe from 2011 to 2014. It showed the Defence Force had information in 2011 that some civilians may have died. That is in conflict with their claims in 2017. There had been no casualties. New Defence Force witnesses may now have to be summoned and others recalled to provide more information. Our defence reporter Jonathan Mitchell has more on what is in those classified documents.
The report from the International Security Assistance Force says deaths may have occurred, contradicting public statements by the military here. After a Native Affairs documentary in 2014, the report was found in the safe. The then Defence Minister Jonathan Coleman was furious and contacted Tim Keating. Dr. Coleman corrected the public record, but then Chief of Defence Tim Keating did not.
When a Minister of the Crown gets up and says civilian casualties may have occurred, and it's widely reported in the media, then I would assume that the public is well assured that with the position that civilian casualties may have occurred as a result of Operation Burnham.
He says he was not forced to correct the record himself because Dr. Coleman had. Tim Keating says he has no idea who put the report in the safe, why it was gathering dust, and not discovered until 2014. However, in 2017, in the immediate rush following the release of Hit and Run, the Chief of Defence repeated the wrong information, ruling out civilian casualties.
But our response was to respond to the accusation that New Zealand Defence Force troops were deliberately involved in civilian casualties to the extent that we deliberately targeted civilians.
Tim Keating admits that response could have been clearer and included a line saying civilians may have died. Military staff have repeatedly told the inquiry they have no idea how Defence got the report by the International Security Assistance Force. The inquiry head asked to see a register of documents, and that's revealed the report was signed in by the Office of the Director of Special Operations. At the time, the director was Jim Blackwell, and the inquiry now wants to hear from him. Tim Keating denies it's been a shambles.
I think that our processes of a defence force weren't coherent in giving the response that we should have been able to give in hindsight now.
More witnesses may now be summoned and others recalled. It's not clear when the inquiry will resume. In Wellington for Morning Report, called Jonathan Mitchell, 10A.
Frightening new figures show since strangulation became a separate offence last December, there have been 1,300 charges laid. People who are strangled are seven times more likely to go on to die at the hands of their abuser. 97% of those charged are men. Making strangulation a separate offence is one of a raft of law changes aimed at tackling New Zealand's domestic violence epidemic. Morning Report's Kim Griggs has this report. And a warning, some of this content is graphic and distressing.
It can take just 10 seconds to lose consciousness. At 15 seconds, you can lose control of your bladder. You can be dead within 2 minutes. Here's how one survivor of family violence describes being strangled.
He pushed me down onto the ground and kind of lay on top of me with his hands around my throat and looked me in my eyes, and as he strangled me, and I couldn't talk, I couldn't scream, I couldn't make any noise. It was you've got no choice but to succumb to it. It's horrific.
She says 2 seconds of being strangled is 2 seconds too long.
Strangulation's terrifying and leaves a big bruised ring around your neck too, so I probably had to wear a scarf or a skivvy or something for days afterwards.
Inspector Fiona Roberts, who manages the family harm section of the police, says strangulation has been an invisible offence up until now.
The symptoms of having been strangled appears often like you're intoxicated. So even the victim's ability to construct a sentence or be able to convey what has happened to them immediately is not something, it's very difficult.
Police officers are having specific training to identify attacks that would count as a strangulation charge. That guidance has come mainly from an American organisation, the Training Institute on Strangulation Prevention, that provides training to law enforcement agencies around the world on how to identify the crime. Inspector Roberts says this training helps officers here understand what's going on.
I've heard of people who've dealt with a victim and just assumed that the victim had smoked just because of the raspy nature of their voice, but it was actually because they'd been strangled. So the next time they saw their victim, they sounded very different.
The chief executive of Women's Refuge, Ange Jury, says the law change will ensure more of a focus on a dangerous crime, and she says it should make people realise how prevalent it is.
The value of it lies in the recognition of how dangerous strangulation is. It would just sort of emerge in their stories that, oh, he held me down by my throat and I couldn't breathe. Those women didn't actually realise how close they were potentially to dying.
Last year, the police attended a family violence incident every 4 minutes. Acting Superintendent Bronwyn Marshall, who leads Safer Whānau at the police, says all New Zealanders need to be asking themselves what they can do to help.
The size of the problem in New Zealand is frightening, and we all collectively need to get on board and think about what can I do to help. If I know something is happening with a friend or with a family member, what can I do to help them? Because unless we all start turning our minds to this, we are not going to be able to change the behaviours that we have got going on in this country.
And you can hear more about how new laws and a new approach are addressing New Zealand's shocking levels of domestic violence on Insight this Sunday morning after the 8 o'clock news. Or you can podcast it now at rnz.co.nz/insight. For Morning Report, Kim Griggs.
Now, of course, if you are in immediate danger because of family violence, call the police on 111. Also, Women's Refuge operates a free national crisis line 24 hours a day, every day. You can call 0800 REFUGE or 0800 733 0800 733 843. That's 0800 733 843. We also have details of other agencies that can help on our website. Go to rnz.co.nz/insight for more information. And it keeps getting worse for Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau as more images are surfacing of him wearing brown and now blackface. The third discovery, this time it's a video from the early 1990s of Mr. Trudeau in dark makeup, raising his hands in the air while laughing, sticking his tongue out and making faces. This follows a tumultuous 24 hours for Justin Trudeau after Time magazine published an image showing the then 29-year-old teacher wearing skin-darkening makeup for a fancy dress party he went to dressed up as Aladdin. Justin Trudeau then admitted to a second incident impersonating a Jamaican as part of a high school talent show. He's just made this fresh apology.
Darkening your face, regardless of the context or the circumstances, is always unacceptable because of the racist history of blackface. I should have understood that then, and I never should have done it.
Mr. Trudeau says he's embarrassed because this doesn't represent the leader he tries to be, defending people's rights and fighting intolerance and racism. However, he can't say for certain whether he wore blackface more than three times.
I am wary of being definitive about this because the recent pictures that came out, I had not remembered. And I think the question is, how can you not remember that? The fact is, I didn't understand how hurtful this is to people who live with discrimination every single day.
Well, this comes just over a month before the country holds its general election. Mr. Trudeau had just pulled ahead of his rival in the polls this week. Let's go to our correspondent in Canada, Laura McQuillan. Laura, a pretty tumultuous 24 hours, probably not even 24 hours for Justin Trudeau. How damaging is this?
Yeah, absolutely. So he's a man who's facing so much criticism right now. You know, some people have come to his defence saying some of this happened 18 years ago or earlier, but his political opponents are really seizing on this. It's the only news here in Canada today. And we've heard from his main political opponent, the leader of the Conservative Party, that in fact his own campaign got that video that you mentioned, that blackface video from the 90s, and passed it on to a media outlet. So now we know how that bit of the story got into the headlines. But in terms of damage to Trudeau, I guess it's going to be one of those things that you know, have to wait and see, because reactions to it have been so mixed. But certainly he's taking this really seriously. The people around him are taking it really seriously. And he's out on the campaign trail. He's got just a month to go. And this is not the story that he wants to have dominating headlines.
Out on the campaign trail, and as we heard there, can't say that these three instances are the only ones.
Yeah, that's right. And he also was asked, why did he never volunteer information about these incidents when he was, you know, vetted to become the Liberal Party leader back in 2013, or to become an MP earlier than that, and in the last federal election back in 2015? Why did he never raise this with anyone? And he said he never talked about it publicly because he's very embarrassed about that behaviour. He should have known better. As you heard in that clip that you played, he's saying he didn't remember the photos being taken. He was asked why as well today. Why would he have done this to begin with? And he says that's a question he's always going to be asking himself. He says it was a terrible idea at the time, but he's saying, you know, he came from a place of privilege. Of course, he's a prime minister's son, and he's saying he's never had to deal with the discrimination or the bias that behaviour like this, wearing blackface, reflects. And he should have known better, but of course he didn't, and now he's facing tough questions over it.
Indeed. Is he going to be able to survive this?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question right now. So he's been asked, will you resign over this? He's saying, well, it's up to voters on October 21st to decide his future. So he's digging in, but something else he's been asked is, what would he do if a candidate had done this? And he's saying he would take that on a case-by-case basis. And here in Canada, the campaign so far has really been one about candidates behaving badly in the past. Lots of social media posts being dug up, people dropping out of the race because of homophobic or racist things they've said on Twitter, on Facebook, things like that. So many incidents from people's past being dug up and their leaders letting them go. Trudeau, now, you know, the shoe is on the other foot, and it's something that he has to deal with from a personal perspective. But right now he says he's going to hang on and he wants to be Prime Minister again come October 21st.
Thank you very much. Laura McQuillan, our correspondent in Canada. Primary schools are unhappy. The Education Ministry says there will be funding for fewer staff next year. The ministry's told the schools their minimum staffing in 2020 will be 151 teachers fewer than this year. Meanwhile, it's told intermediate and secondary schools there will be more students, and it's guaranteeing to pay for at least 370 more teachers. Here's our education correspondent, John Gerritsen.
This time last year, the ministry estimated primary schools would have more than 431,000 children by October this year, and it guaranteed funding for 21,551 teachers. It's not yet clear how many have actually enrolled, but now the ministry's telling schools that next year's estimate is for 2,500 fewer students, and that means primary schools are entitled to 151 fewer teachers. Fetu Cormick from the Principals Federation says that's not a big drop when spread across 2,000 schools, but many are complaining that the ministry's got it wrong.
I'm hearing across the country that school principals are unhappy with the unconfirmed staffing entitlement for next year. And in many cases, I'm hearing from school leaders that they have a reduction in their staffing. And some of these people have gone back to their local ministry office to question whether or not these numbers are correct.
Heath McNeil from the Auckland Primary Principals Association says more than 200 schools responded in just one day to a survey this week about staffing entitlements, and many are not happy.
We've got just around half of our schools surveyed going to put in for a staffing review because they believe that the numbers that the Wellington Ministry have created for next year are insufficient for the growth that they're experiencing.
Heath McNeil says in some cases schools have been told they'll have fewer teachers, even though the ministry's built more classrooms in anticipation of role growth.
In a school, for example, where they've got three new classrooms because of role growth, their staffing entitlement has gone down. So the property division of the ministry is saying, yes, we know that you're going to grow by three classrooms, but the resourcing part of the ministry appear as though they haven't been given that information.
Mr McNeil says schools can contest the ministry's estimate, but that can be a drawn-out process. Meanwhile, secondary schools have been told the ministry will fund 200 more teachers next year to keep up with enrolment growth. Deirdre Shea from the Secondary Principals Association says finding those staff will be a challenge.
There will be real concern about finding quality teachers across the country to fill those roles. Again, it's something we've been very aware of. There have been a number of initiatives put in place to address short-term supply issues, and that's been really helpful.
The Education Ministry says its entitlement estimates are used to give schools certainty about the next year's staffing, but they're not definitive. It says it recalculates staffing in March each year so it can increase staffing entitlements for schools that need it. Mo te hotaka o te ata, ko John Gerritsen tēnei.
Well, is it okay to eat fat? If so, what kind of fat? Jim Mann is an advisor to the World Health Organization and professor of human nutrition at Otago University. Today he will be speaking about the confusion of conflicting messages about food at a nutrition symposium in Wellington. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Now, these confusing messages, I have to admit. I mean, from time to time, I'm prone to the odd bout of a paleo diet here or there to try and, you know, kickstart things. It is very confusing at the moment.
Well, I think it is confusing. Let me just reassure you that the odd go at a paleo diet probably won't do you too much harm. It certainly won't do you any good.
Really?
But as long as you don't stick with it, I think it's probably okay. But nutrition messages are very confused, and I think social media is to some extent responsible. But what I'm talking about today is what is evidence. What is the evidence base for good nutrition?
Okay, well, lay it out for us.
Well, I mean, I think the important thing is that one has to look at the overall body of evidence. One has to look at what happens to populations. One has to look at clinical trials. One looks at what are called prospective or cohort studies, and you put it all together. And what you discover, if you put all that together, is that a wide range of food intakes is acceptable. What is more important is not whether you have a low-fat diet or a high-carb diet or vice versa, but what is important is the type of fat and the type of carbohydrate and the sort of foods you eat. So, for example, a range of carbohydrate intake is fine. You can have a relatively low or relatively high carbohydrate diet, but you've got to have the right kind of carbohydrates.
So what's a bad carbohydrate?
Well, a bad carbohydrate, I think is very bad if you don't have much of it. But sugar, for instance, is not of much use to anybody other than sweetening. So, yes, it's fine to have some sugar, but that should be restricted. I think where there's a great deal of confusion about carbohydrate is that a lot of carbohydrate is very rapidly digested and absorbed. And at the end of the day, it's not much different from sugar. Or glucose anyway. So one wants to have slowly absorbed carbohydrate, and the slowly absorbed carbohydrates are the whole grain, genuine whole grain carbohydrate. They're the carbohydrates that are in fruit and vegetables where the cell wall makes digestion and absorption rather slower. And those kind of carbohydrates are fine.
So what about a fan of French fries, potatoes?
Not a lot of merit in those because they're usually fried in undesirable fat, very often reused fat, depending on where you get them. And the potatoes themselves, hot potatoes, very rapidly digested and absorbed. So not particularly to be recommended on two counts.
The fat's interesting and the sugar's interesting. So it seems to me that in the 80s and 90s, the messaging was all about low fat butter, low fat, all these sort of things. But there were lots of sugar being put into foods, and now we sort of see it seems to be going the other way. Yeah.
Well, I think the messaging is terribly important, and I think some of the messaging was wrong 20, 30 years ago, because I think it did lead to a reduction of fat and an introduction of the wrong kind of carbohydrate. And that, I think, is where some of the confusion, considerable confusion, arose. So really what the messaging is eat the right kind of fats in moderation, eat the right kinds of carbohydrates, and don't go for any extreme versions of diet that you read about on social media or anywhere else, because they're probably not going to be good for you.
Problem is the marketing and the messaging that people are getting in a lot of media and a lot of advertising is really making that salty, fatty carbohydrates attractive.
Yeah, well, I agree entirely, and certainly one of the things that I believe should be done, particularly in terms of children, is there should be some kind of severe restriction on advertising, especially to children. I think that is incredibly important. Advertising is grossly misleading, and even some foods are sold as healthy foods when they really are not so. But governments have been very, very reticent about any kind of restriction on advertising, unfortunately.
Okay, just coming back, sorry to bring it back to the paleo diet. Just the ideas, though, there are a lot of fad diets around. I think, what's the other one, the keto diet, is that the other one that seems to be very popular at the moment? Yeah. But this idea that you cut out carbohydrates, you focus on protein and vegetables, seems to be a very popular trend at the moment.
It is very popular. And its popularity is based on a number of things. One, there is some short-term benefits if you go on to what is called a keto diet, which is a very low carbohydrate diet. And it does promote rapid weight loss. But there is no evidence that it promotes long-term weight loss. There is no evidence that it's safe in the long term. And one of the big problems is that many people who are promoting it are really sponsored by a range of industries that are benefiting, or very often themselves that are benefiting. And there's an organization called Diet Doctor, which looks terribly authentic. You see doctors with stethoscopes around their neck, you know, trust us, we're doctors, we must be right. And, I mean, they are commercial organisations that are making a lot of money out of something that is entirely unproven in the long term and may actually be detrimental to health. We just don't know.
Is there any evidence about how to make changes to your diet that can be lasting? Because we hear a lot about people falling on or off diets. But how do you make those small changes that you can bed in that will actually make a difference?
Well, I think if I can not answer your question to start off with, and that is that you've really got to start off teaching children and teaching the population what is right for good health generally, not starting with people who are middle-aged or older who are overweight and want to lose weight. It's jolly difficult to do that. It is possible to do that, and there are various behavioural techniques which can be employed. Some people are stronger-willed than others, but that is much harder than tackling the thing at a population level. And I think we've got to create an environment, and the government has a critical role to play here. We've got to create an environment where health healthy eating is easy eating. And right now, it isn't.
Jim Mann, thank you very much for your time. A professor of human nutrition at Otago University.
You've been listening to Morning Report Top Stories from RadioNZ.co.nz.